Let's make it happen, Captain.
From deep inside the Death Star, I'm Larry Larson.
And I'm Gov Maharaj.
And welcome to Defrag. And it's been a while. When's the last time we shot? It was
before the holidays.
The Christmas show was when it actually aired, which means we shot a little bit before that. And since
about 3 weeks.
Yeah, I think so. And then we had the holidays, and then I was out for CES. So we are back. Send your questions. We are here to help. So.
Please be complete when you're sending questions, screenshots, error codes, as much information as you possibly can. What was the last thing that you did? These all help.
Or as Gov would say, what did you do to screw this up? I saw a couple of those go through. Yeah.
What did you do?
So let's get started. From Robert, he says, hi guys, I have a PC that net logon service will not start. I'm trying to connect it to a share. I saw that Server 2003 had this problem and has a fix. Do you know if there's a fix for Windows 8?
It's
and
not
you said,
broken.
What did you do to screw this up?
So NetLogon is a manual start service. It's there for domain join machines. You don't need to start it manually. A default install of Windows does not have it started by default. The issue that Robert was having has nothing to do with NetLogon. We believe at this point it actually has to do with the fact that he swapped out his router and there's some sort of misconfiguration. His setup is rather complex, but it is not due to the NetLogon service.
Yeah.
There is some configuration either with Windows, it was an upgraded system, plus the fact that his router got changed, that there's some incompatibility with the NAS Synology NAS system. Those Samba-based NAS, you know, that run some flavor of Linux, occasionally have issues because they are forcing a lower encryption value, which you can actually turn down the encryption when you're connecting to shares. But honestly, the best thing that you can do, and I can show you how to change the advanced sharing here. So if you're under private, so you go to Networking Sharing Center, Advanced Sharing Settings. Under File Sharing Connections, we default to 128-bit encryption, but depending on certain NAS firmwares or versions that you're running, they might require 40 or 56-bit encryption. We don't recommend turning it down to 40 or 56-bit. What we would actually recommend is looking for updates for your NAS to see if they upgrade to 128. Mm-hmm. That's the ideal solution.
Cool. All right, next question from me. And I was just sitting there watching TV one night, and on my computer, on my Windows 8.1 machine, popped up a message that said, the Microsoft iSCSI service is not running. The service is required for iSCSI to function correctly. Do you want to start the service and have it run automatically each time you start your computer? Kind of freaked me out because, you know, I got the two RAIDs going on. I have a problem with one of the drives still where I got to reset it every once in a while, but it seems to be okay. And I didn't know if this was part of that problem or if turning it off was going to cause a problem with my RAID somehow, or if I should even have it on, or even what
you don't need. You don't need it running. I'd actually like to see the message, see what actually caused it, because the iSCSI initiator is for external SANs, storage attached networks. You're not likely to have this at home.
Yeah, I don't have it.
So something obviously triggered the message. I'd like to actually know what it was, but you know, bring in your event log to see what happened.
Okay, so explain what iSCSI is, first of all, just to get that out of the way.
It's basically a way of addressing storage attached networks. It's a protocol that's used to basically treat your drive array that usually runs over a fiber channel or it's network attached using SCSI commands because it's a standardized way of addressing external storage.
Okay, and so if you don't have one of those and you happen to get this message for whatever reason, you'd say no.
Probably say no. Yeah,
which I did and everything was fine.
Right.
So that was great. All right, from Mikhail, he says, this might be a stupid question. In the episode of Bachman-Meyer Overdrive on Channel 9, What kind of liquid is in the hard drive and what is it for? If the liquid is later filled in stuff, are there hard drives on the market that have some kind of liquid in? All right, so I watched this video.
Mm-hmm.
And this,
I had no idea what this was.
This was a goof. So there's no way that there's liquid like this in hard drives. And you see when they crack it open that there's a couple drops of the liquid on the platter.
Mm-hmm.
And so this obviously had to be a goof. And when I stopped the video, when I paused the video and I was looking at it, because it looks like a coffee or something,
mm-hmm.
Or like a mug root beer or something like that, it had bubbles in it. So
Did something spilled inside of it?
No, I think they were just goofing around because they were talking about acid and databases and stuff like that. So I think they had cracked the hard drive open and poured some liquid in there just to be fun. And so, but don't take that for real. You've mm-hmm. never, have you even heard of a hard drive? It seems like it would just slow it down.
An actual fluid-filled hard drive?
Yeah.
I have not.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I've cracked open dozens of hard drives, and I've never seen a liquid in any of them. So
I mean, the only ones in very early drives would have been used for the lubrication of the bearings.
Yeah, you I know, could see that.
That would be it.
Cool it or something like that. But
I've never seen it.
Would just get in the way and cause no end of problems. And so no, I and Golnaz was probably there. She probably saw this happen, but. I'm sure it was just like some mug root beer or something for effect to help with their joke. So, yeah, no liquid in there. Don't sweat it. Next question from Ian. He says, I'm wondering what would happen if a Windows 8.1 or Windows 8.x user who has their default file save location for all files, a SkyDrive, got infected by one of these ransomware infections that encrypts your files and then demands payment to decrypt the files. Would the files on the SkyDrive be encrypted if the files were set to make available offline, and then those files synced across other machines? I would assume that those set to online only would be unaffected if left in online mode because they are simply pointers and not files. Is there versioning on SkyDrive? Has had a quick look and couldn't see that mentioned on the SkyDrive site.
Well, let's address the versioning question first. There is no versioning, as far as I'm aware, on SkyDrive. It's basically last writer wins.
Yeah.
As for the ransomware, it kind of depends on the type of ransomware you use. But if you take it, you know, right back down to basics, is that if you have any code that is running as your user account that has access to your user files, mm-hmm. and it can encrypt them, right? If it is marked as offline only, that means that the files on SkyDrive are physically residing on your computer here.
Yeah.
They will sync back to SkyDrive. So if they're encrypted here, they will sync back to SkyDrive, and for any machine in which they are marked as offline as well, they will go down to those machines as encrypted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing to remember, though, is that if you have malware running on your system that can encrypt your files, nothing particularly stops it from taking an online-only file and marking it as offline-only and syncing it down and then encrypting it and then having it sent back to SkyDrive.
Yeah.
These ransomwares are pretty malicious, right? Mm-hmm. You got to wonder where you're getting it from. If you're getting it from browsing the internet, going to unsafe sites, then it can potentially break out any of the sandboxes and encrypt the files. Now, normally, you know, if you're running IE, Chrome, any of the browsers, they don't have direct access to your user files, mm-hmm. right? So they have to break out of any of those sandboxes in order to have access to your user files and then do that. Now, that's pretty heinous, and there's really not a lot that you can do about it other than running anti-malware and making sure that you're not going to questionable sites.
Yeah.
This is one of those problems where running as a standard user doesn't actually help you because it is only affecting things that your user already has access to as well.
Mm-hmm.
So basic statement is that if you have malicious code running as you, it can do far more damage to you than running as admin because, you know, what is technically worse for you or me? Something that corrupts your OS or something that corrupts your data?
Data,
of course. Now, something that corrupts your data, that can just run as you. That can run as the most limited user that you have if you can write to the files, malware can write to the files. So you have to make sure you don't get the malware writing on the system in the first place.
Yeah. And it's good practice to have, you know, offline backup too. I mean, that's why I have hard drives in a safe and other hard drives.
Offline backups are really essential. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you want to back up the stuff that is not corrupted.
Yeah. All right. Next question from Greg. I'm a noob at IPv6, so please bear with my ignorance. In the 1219 episode, Gove talked about directly remoting into machines using IPv6. Can that be accomplished if the client computer is on IPv4 connection? This may be a great solution to me to use for school.
Technically speaking, it's complicated. if you go to, you know, an admin command prompt and you go ipconfig whack all, it will show you various configurations on your system related to networking. Now, for me, I have a real IPv6 address. Now, this is a corporate managed machine,
yeah.
So your information will vary a little bit. I have a real IPv6 address, and if you go down, usually somewhere towards the bottom, you'll find something called the Teredo Tunneling Pseudo Interface. On your home machine, this will likely have a real IPv6 address. What that does is it basically takes IPv6 information, tunnels it over IPv4 to servers on the internet, and then allows you to tunnel the IPv6 information back to any other system that is only connected via IPv4.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can actually set up this remoting with the Teredo interface, but it's not always reliable because Teredo behind NATs are not always reliable.
Yeah.
You have to open up various ports because the Teredo interface on Windows machines is really designed for the home networking. So UPnP, home groups, all the stuff that you do at home is really used over IPv6 by default. And your home router tends to stop that. You know, it doesn't want to have this information go out onto the regular internet. So you can configure it so that this Teredo IPv6 address is unique. You know, so this machine will have a different Teredo IPv6 than this machine, and you could access it over the IPv4 network. However, I do recommend, if you can, get real IPv6.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The other thing you have to realize is that many home routers, if you're using real IPv6, can't actually handle IPv6 traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And there are some routers on the internet that will actively snoop for Teredo encapsulated IPv6 traffic and then block it. So okay. Your ISP may do some interesting things around that too.
Hmm. Okay. All right, from Pedro, I finally started making good use of SkyDrive across my devices and want to know if there's a built-in way to encrypt the contents of my micro SD card on my Surface 2, not Pro. I am pointing my local SkyDrive folder to it and wanted to keep a few files local and encrypted. I use BitLocker on my laptop, but I didn't see any option for this on the Surface.
The Surface does not have this option natively.
Mm-hmm.
However, if you take it to any x86 machine running Pro, you can turn on BitLocker to Go on that micro SD card. Turning on BitLocker to Go will allow it to be used in any Windows machine at that point. It doesn't matter if it's Surface, if it's x86, if it's non-Pro. Once it's been encrypted with BitLocker to Go, you're good to go.
Okay, good. From Marco, is there a Microsoft website where I can report bugs in Windows?
The best site is the answers.microsoft.com.
Okay.
We have MVPs on here. We have our own customer support that will go looking for issues. We have product teams that will be constantly looking at issues here. This is the single most best direct way of reporting bugs across a variety of products, other than, of course, asking us questions.
Yeah, if you send a question here, you know.
That's another method.
Yeah, both you, Andrew Richards, and Chad Bader, they've all, I mean, you're all filing right. Bugs all the time, so. Okay, from Toby, how come Task Manager in Windows 8.1 reports my CPU speed isn't quite what it should be, e.g. 3.36, 3.76, and 3.96? Also, the memory is the same for RAM. It's 31.9. Second question is, how can I use more RAM? I bought 32 gig a while back, and I don't generally see much more than 8 gig used. Can I use more to make my computer faster?
Okay, so first talking about the CPU numbers.
Yeah.
You're likely running SpeedSep CPU, so its speed will change. Like right now, my CPU is doing jack all. Mm-hmm. So its CPU speed is very, very low. It throttles down. And this particular processor is clocked at 1.6, but it can also be throttled up to 2.3. So this is essentially what you're seeing.
Yeah.
Now, for your RAM, it really depends on... So, for me, I have 3.9 here as well. It is a 4 gig system.
Yeah.
Right? So that's what it will actually report to here. This 3.9 is probably just a rounding issue. Mm-hmm. Or it is the memory that is taken away for the video card.
But the long and short of it is the machine is going to use what it needs, and there's nothing that going in and monkeying around with things is going to make it a better
Right, so machine. Whatever it is that you're running currently is using up around 8 gig of RAM.
Yeah.
Right? And if you have more intensive things, then it will use more available memory.
Yeah.
But it will... The thing with when you have more RAM is that you will be able to not use the page file as much.
Yeah.
Things will persist in RAM longer.
Yeah.
This is a good thing, and the system will utilize as much of the RAM as it is requested of it. Mm-hmm. Right? If you don't have processes that are running that are actively requesting, you know, the maximum amount of memory per process, which you really shouldn't, mm-hmm. right? So if you have 32-bit processes, it's user accessible is 2 gig worth. If you have 64-bit, it can go to, you know, significantly higher memory usage, but those applications themselves won't be requesting all available RAM in your system.
Yeah.
It'll only request the RAM that it requires.
Yeah, and the other thing about this is 32 gig of RAM is a lot of RAM.
Meh.
I think it is. I mean,
I've maxed out my boards.
I have too. But one thing that maybe you might want to do is think about using a RAM drive for half that. Because a 16 gig RAM drive, I mean, a RAM drive is about 10 times faster than an SSD.
Mm-hmm.
So
if you're just as long as you don't use it as a swap drive.
Yeah.
Right. If you're using it for Photoshop, Scratch.
Yeah.
That. Well,
I'll show you a
definitely
good
case
use for this. If I'm at home and I want to edit a Premiere video,
there you go.
Copy all the files that I'm going to edit to that RAM drive, and then edit them from there and render them to there, mm-hmm. and you will see speeds like you've never seen before.
Of course.
It's pretty incredible.
Now, Premiere also has settings specifically for RAM drive usage, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does.
I vaguely recall because that, like, rendering is one of those mainline scenarios where people do use RAM drives.
Yeah, but if you've got a CUDA card, a really good CUDA card that you're rendering with Premiere with, usually your bottleneck is going to be in the hard drive.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're SSD, I mean, your bottleneck's going to end up being in the hard drive. So,
absolutely.
By using a RAM drive, you're going to be able to up that quite a bit. So, all right, next question from Robbie. I've got an odd problem. My brother upgraded to Windows 8.1 with no problems. Then he says he installed a Windows 7 AMD graphic driver. Now when he reboots, it shows a blank black screen. He didn't make a recovery disk. Since he can't see the screen, is there any way they can get into safe mode to disable the graphic driver without a recovery disk?
So in Windows 8 and 8.1, the regular, you know, mash on a key to get to safe mode is essentially gone because of how fast systems are booting.
Yeah.
There's not enough time to actually do that. So basically what you're trying to do, we have this fail safe where if you fail to boot three times, it'll go into the recovery options.
Mm-hmm.
So basically that's what you do is while you're booting, hold down the power button, reboot it again while it's booting, hold out. Do that three times so that it fails the boot three times, because what's happening with the black screen is actually getting to a point where it's past the boot and initializing the graphics driver, but there it's failing.
Yeah.
So you want to fail it earlier than that. And then at that point, you can disable the graphics driver by going into the recovery partition.
Okay, and that did work. So next question from Pepe. He says, I recently upgraded to Windows 8.1. Since then, my computer would freeze when I was playing Pogo games. Also, it'd go very slow, and the pixels would break up in pieces, so I stopped playing them for a while. Then the other day, it froze as soon as I turned it on. I'm confused. Is it the games, Windows 8.1, or the computer?
I have no idea what Pogo games are.
It's Flash games. Okay. So it sounds like he's trying to play Flash games on a site, and those are having errors. And I would say that error is probably Flash related. So
it certainly could be Flash related. The OS with Windows 8 and 8.1 flashes automatically updated via Windows Update. So you can't independently update it.
Yeah.
Basically, for this one, I need more information. So which specific games, send a DX diag of your system, because it may not just be Flash, it actually could be your video drivers as well.
Yeah.
The other thing would be,
I'd try a different browser too and see.
The problem with a different browser is that it's going to, if it is Flash, it'll be not the Flash OCX, it'll be something completely different.
Yeah.
So what I'd like to see is actually a different Flash site with like the similar game.
Yeah.
But does it work on a different Flash site? So is it the site itself that's the problem?
Yeah.
That's basically all that I've got for given the limited information.
Yeah. Okay, so let us know. All right, pick of the week time. Pick of the week. And the first pick of the week is CES. So I went to CES. This is the first time that I've been to a conference that I wasn't working. So it was magical. It was just go around and see everything cool. That was really neat. And Gavin Gear from the Windows Extreme blog shot a bunch of videos on different laptops that were there. So a lot of those are on Channel 9, so go check that out. And you can see some of the different stuff. I'll give you the highlights that I saw. Curved screens everywhere. I mean, they were just everywhere. And a lot of them were pretty cool. I saw some desktop monitors that were curved. And I could see a big appeal with that. It was just kind of neat.
A little bit more immersive, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And they were very wide, like 21 by, I don't know, what would be the ratio there. But they were really wide displays.
Were they like two monitors curved, or is it more like a triple monitor that's curved?
It felt like my home screen with three monitors. It was like that wide. A lot of those monitors that I saw like that were pretty small for now. But high resolution. There were a lot of TVs there, too, that had curved displays. 4K and a little bit of 8K everywhere. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of cool. I saw some really big 4K displays. And every time I looked at one of those really big 4K displays, you were in the back of my mind thinking about the calculator. And you want to be back a ways from those really big displays, especially, you know, 4K. The other thing that was really big this year is there were a lot of robotics and 3D printing. I saw robots to clean your grill. They had robots that would clean your windows.
As long as they don't make a robot that grills for me, because that would just be sacrilege.
Yeah, you don't want that. But the robot to clean the windows would like suction cup onto the window and then do like a Roomba. Window, which was pretty cool. All kinds of different stuff there. But check out Gavin's videos. The laptop, I looked at a lot of different laptops, and the one that really stood out to me was the Sony Vaio Flip.
It looks like a pretty interesting system.
Yeah, it won an innovation award at CES. And you've probably seen the Dell with the screen that flips around. And that's just, I mean, if you've ever used one, it kind of feels plasticky. This device, the mechanism that Sony's got on this device, is amazingly solid. So when you go to flip it feels almost like the extension leg on a Surface, how it just snaps and it feels
nice and
very solid. It's like that, only the screen, you know, snaps backwards and then it folds down. So the nice thing with this is you can have a convertible laptop like this that you can end up using as a tablet, and then the keys aren't on the bottom, which is, you know, kind of a problem with some of the past ones. The other thing that stood out to me with the Vaio Flip was the pen was incredible. It was the best pen that I've ever used on a computer. It was.
You'd use this as a graphics tablet?
Yeah. You could use it, you know, for writing notes or for. I'd use it for Photoshop and stuff like that because I just really love using a stylus.
Right.
It was because the pen was weighted right. It just was just a magical pen to use. So
it'd be great if you could click it and actually turn it into a real pen. That would be an interesting innovation right there.
$1 million idea. He gives it to you for free.
Right.
So there you go. It was a really nice laptop, and starting at $799, you can't beat the price on that. It's pretty good. The other thing that I wanted to bring back a past pick of the week. With the Seiki 4K TV, which we talked about right before Christmas as being a really cool display that you could use as a monitor. And I mentioned how Gavin Gear was using one in his office. Well, Santa brought me one. So one just kind of showed up in my house. And I got a chance to actually use it hands-on for a long period of time on my computer. And it wouldn't be my first recommendation. I mean, if you've got one monitor on your computer, it shouldn't be that TV.
Mm-hmm.
It is really cool having that much resolution.
Sure.
You can read an entire page of Reddit without any scrolling, which is just really cool. But as far as a monitor, the problems that I had with it was the color space and the adjustments on it to try to get the color right to match other monitors on my desk. It's just not there. And that's, it's a TV. So better a TV than a computer monitor, I think. But for $500, I mean, you're getting what you pay for, but it's not going to be the best monitor you use.
Color calibration, this is more of a TV related tool as opposed to a computer monitor related tool. But
yeah.
This is probably the best benchmark in the world for Blu-ray and HDTV or HD-DVD calibration. So if Santa has brought anyone new televisions for the holidays, if you calibrate it, you will get so much better use out of it. A lot of times, if you go to a brick and mortar store, you see the TVs there and they've just been cranked up. Mm-hmm. Everything is overblown, everything is oversaturated, and the lighting in the store makes it so that it looks kind of okay. Like, a lot of TVs actually have a preset for store, like store demo, for example, that totally changes how it looks when it comes home. There are a lot of TVs, that will come relatively pre-calibrated, but depending on how the lighting in your space is, you should actually recalibrate it so that, if you're more in a darkened room and it's perpetually dark and, for movie usage, mm-hmm. You don't want things to be overblown and oversaturated. Some of the presets on a lot of them, like cinema, game, they can cause things, especially on the higher-end TVs. Have you heard of the soap opera effect on TVs?
Yeah, where it looks...
It looks like you're watching a soap opera.
Yeah.
You can use this calibration tool in order to get rid of that, and so you can have a much better experience with your TVs. And you could technically use it as well for computer monitors, but it was based off of a Blu-ray disc, so you'll need to come out...
So you've used this on your home machine?
Absolutely.
And how do you do it? I mean, you put the Blu-ray in, and it says,
It comes with a card.
Okay.
It comes with various tests. It's to make it look good to you, right? So there's various settings that you can do that say,
So you're matching the screen to a card in front of you to try to get it the most exact you can.
Well, you have the screen and it basically tells you, change this setting so that this and this start looking the same, or that this and this, you start seeing contrast,
Cool. Okay.
So that's what this tool does. Spears and Munsell, fantastic calibration. Highly, highly recommend it. It's won numerous awards and, recommendations from various folks. And this made a huge difference with my 3-year-old Panasonic plasma TV. It made a world of difference.
Yeah, cool, nice. All right, that's the show for this week. If you have questions, write us at deepfragshow@microsoft.com, and we will see you next week.
Take care.